Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. Daniel, good to see you today.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
Well, doing well. I don't think this is a day we celebrate. It's not the kind of holiday it
Shouldn't
is, but there
know.
Sure is a lot of noise going out there. And maybe some people who have ulterior motives might be sort of gloating. But it's a sad day, and that, of course, is 9/11 and what happened in New York and Pennsylvania and all this tragedy that went on. But, you know, it's really a shame that it hasn't been really answered. There's still a lot of questions. You know, you have your conspiracy people that might be a little bit more than you can even understand.
Yeah.
But then there's the government official report. And, of course, my argument over the years has been that if you have a government commission to investigate something, you know, whether it's the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, or the Lincoln assassination,
yeah.
You never get to the bottom of it. And my argument always has been that most of the time it's just a cover-up. Maybe they aren't really responsible for it all, but they might be responsible in the sense that they goofed up and didn't prevent it.
Yeah.
And so it's protecting the government. And I think that now probably the majority of the American people now are not satisfied with the fully understanding. They certainly aren't satisfied at all about the Kennedy assassination. So this is... This is a sad story, you know, and just looking at the headlines, some put out how much money we've spent. Always money, you know, and this cracked down. So what did they spend? $5.6 trillion fighting more wars, doing more things. And then there's a grain of truth to my suspicion that 9/11 is a consequence of bad foreign policy. All this $5.6 trillion is to perpetuate that bad foreign policy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think we're going to have good results. At least the result is that somebody got rich over it, and we've spent a lot of money. And as far as I'm concerned, it's like it would have been better to put the money down a drain,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
than what's happened, because we've just caused more and more trouble. But there are the people who talk about the finances and you know, the foreign policy. But John Rutherford, our friend.
John Whitehead, yeah.
Whitehead,
yeah.
John, at the Rutherford Institute.
Yeah.
He did a great article, which was discouraging because he listed all the dumb things we've done. You know,
it's a long list.
Fortunately, at the end, he gives us a little bit of hope and is positive on what we ought to do. But John, you know, had a whole list of where we've gone backwards. So actually, we haven't gained a whole lot, or I think an answer to our proposed question. I don't think we've learned anything. Unfortunately, policy has gotten much worse.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, it was, I guess I was closer to it than most people. I was less than a mile from the Pentagon. I've probably said this on the show before. My son was a toddler. He was toddling around the living room. I hadn't gone to work for you yet, and I was reading the morning paper, drinking a coffee. We had a skylight, and the shadow went across the skylight, and we felt the percussion of the collision into the Pentagon immediately afterwards. So we immediately got in our car and drove over there, and it was just mayhem and chaos. So it was really something close to home. But my son, that little toddler, now is going to college. And that whole time, from then till now, we've been at war. We've been at the war on terror. We've been doing all of these things. We've been spending, and you pointed out, this was Brown University's Cost of War Project, where they say $5.6 trillion by the end of fiscal year 2018 spent on this so-called war on terror. Wars in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, they point out, along with increased spending in Homeland Security, Department of Defense, State, and Veterans Affairs. So here's what we've done in the meantime, 17 years of this.
And so many dumb things have happened since then. But the one thing that bothered me the most at the beginning, that first week was really hectic, you know, the new legislation and the preparation for more war and all. But the Patriot Act came up very, very quickly, dealing with our liberties.
Amazing how quick they had that handy.
And they had and it was acknowledged. It had been written around for emergency purposes, but maybe they needed a Pearl Harbor event, which some neocons have written about. You can do a lot with a Pearl Harbor event. You know, the people have to succumb, and you can do a lot more. But it was the preparation for this. And, you know, the whole concept of TSA and NDAA, there was so much of that that had been thought about and planned. But certainly the Patriot Act, you know, was something that was on the books, and it went through pretty easily. And it meant more problems for us. I can remember sitting next to another member of Congress. I was friendly with him, and we were talking. I said, "You're voting for this?" He said, "Yeah, oh, yeah." And I said, "Well, you know, it has a lot of bad stuff in it." Even though we didn't have much time to read, some of us knew there was bad stuff. He says, "Yeah, I know that." He says, "I know there's some bad stuff in there, but how can you vote against the Patriot Act on a day like this?"
Yeah.
So he felt the intense pressure. There's no way. He says, "How could I go back to my district and tell the people under these circumstances that the government's going to react in a positive manner and give us the Patriot Act?" And they wouldn't understand. I said, "Well, maybe that's your job. Maybe you ought to vote the right way and go home and explain it to your people why you're voting a certain way." But that was the typical reaction. You know, the pressure was very great, to just go ahead and endorse it. And we have been suffering ever since. And John Whitehead has certainly points that out, as many others have, how disastrous the Patriot Act is.
And ironically, and it probably drives the neocons crazy, but it was your opposition, your early opposition to the Patriot Act, viewed as something you could never do, which sort of fueled your big rise a few years later into the two campaigns. So they actually did you a big favor by giving you something you could vote no on.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were looking at Whitehead's piece, and he linked to something that is fascinating, actually. It was an interview with Osama bin Laden that was run in 2002, his first interview after the 9/11 attacks. And this quote is fascinating in the context of what we're saying now. He said, this is what bin Laden said, "I tell you, freedom and human rights in America are doomed. The U.S. government will lead the American people and the West in general into an unbearable hell and choking life," which is essentially what's happened. It's strange. And, you know, Ari Fleischer was quoted in an article about this. Okay, and here's his reaction. "Everyone knows how evil Osama bin Laden is. This tape showed the importance of completing the mission and protecting freedom." Well, the mission is exactly what they did these 17 years to destroy the freedom.
Yeah, and we set the stage for it. And it was said at the time, I read, I don't have the actual quote, but he, bin Laden, essentially said, "I never dreamed the Americans would be such a strong reaction, which falls into their lap,"
yeah,
"and that they could go and do much more," because he thought we would there be a response, but that we wouldn't come over and invade the Middle East and be there for all these years and make ourselves an easier target. And there was also a quote from bin Laden. You know, some people still question, was he the ringleader? Did he do all of it? And we certainly know he was with the Al-Qaeda and
yeah,
knew something about him, and he wanted the credit for it.
Yeah.
But his statement was there were three reasons why this happened. One was the constant bombing on Iraq, the mistreatment of the Palestinians, and the invasion of the Holy Land and putting our military in Saudi Arabia. And remember, afterwards, even one of our officials decided...
It was Bolton, I think. Yeah.
We need to take him out because this made him angry.
Yeah.
You know, they admitted that. But they give these reasons. So what do? We go and invade more countries and do exactly the same thing that incited their hatred toward us.
Well, you know, the conspiracy theorists might say the CIA did create the Mujahideen and did create bin Laden. Maybe he was still on the payroll because he sure made a lot of work for them over the years, hasn't he? But, you know, Whitehead's piece is good for a number of reasons. And if I can just read a quote here, it puts everything also in context, in the broader context. And here's what John writes. "While 3,000 people died in the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government and its agents have easily killed at least 10 times that number of civilians in the U.S. and abroad through police shootings, SWAT team raids, drone strikes, profit-driven efforts to police the globe, selling weapons to foreign nations, and fomenting civil unrest in order to keep the military-industrial complex gainfully employed."
And, you know, the reaction to the bad guys will be, well, he's unpatriotic, he's un-American, he's hate America first by telling the truth.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tough job to tell the truth when it challenges the conventional wisdom of what patriotism is. And patriotism should not be obedience to the state even when they do wrong.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's about, where we are. But, you know, there's been the ups and downs of Al-Qaeda, so many different groups that you have to keep track of. But there's actually the argument that the Al-Qaeda is stronger than ever. You know, they're not one group. They're not a caliphate. I don't think anybody's arguing that. But there's various groups, but it seems like they are unified over one thing, hatred toward the United States. And if you go through some of these countries, they had no Al-Qaeda until after we went in. Iraq was, in particular, remember that was used as one of the reasons why we went in. And now they're still fighting over there, and the Al-Qaeda is still involved. But, you know, in the various countries, Yemen and Somalia and Afghanistan, all these places, they exist. Syria, and we're on the wrong side in Syria. We're actually aligning ourselves with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, it's, you know, and we both saw this piece of the LA Times. It was linked on antiwar.com. It was pretty remarkable to read. It was yesterday that it came in. And the headline says it all, 17 years after September 11th, Al-Qaeda might be stronger than ever. You know, can we get a refund for these few trillion dollars? And they make a great point. This is not rocket science. You know, I think you predicted this only about 1,000 times. Far from vanquishing the extremist group and its associated franchises, critics say U.S. policies in the Middle East appear to have encouraged its spread. You know, they arose because of our meddling in the region. We quadrupled our meddling in the region, and they got bigger. It's not rocket science.
The biggest challenge is for us, which is a constant challenge, is how do we get more people to see it in a different manner than what they see in the evening news? You would think that with the people now, polls have shown that a large majority, 60, 70% of the people don't trust the government anymore, and they hate the media, and that's been encouraged by our president, which does no harm to challenge the media. And yet, at the same time, if you'd pin them down on this, it just seems to be that this is subtle, and it's out there, and you're unpatriotic, and leadership of both parties, you know, usually endorse these. In spite of the fighting goes on, you know, when it comes to bashing Russia, for instance, or having a position in Syria, there's no real challenge there, and the American people seem to go along with it, and that to me is a frustrating thing. Also, one of the things that motivates me to try to get this information out, and I think at times that we do reach a few people, and there's some good websites out there. Look at Zero Hedge and Lou Rockwell and these different people. Yeah. They carry material like this, and so I think the sentiment is there. Other people just sort of seem to go along because they don't know a lot better, and they're sort of apathetic about looking at the details.
Well, after 17 years of doing the same thing, which has not produced results, I mean, nobody can deny that it has not produced the results that it was supposed to. LA Times telling us they're stronger than ever. You know, it looks increasingly, and I think John Whitehead writes about this a lot, the war on terror really is actually a war on us. You know, when we go to the airport, what happens to us? We get molested. We get treated like we're animals. What happens when in our private phone calls, our private emails, our private text messages, everything is being taken up. The militarization of the police since 9/11 is incredible. The violations of our other civil liberties, it really is a war on us rather than a war on terror.
Yeah, in the argument so often, I've heard it, you know, when I'd vote against something like the Patriot Act, that Ron, you have to realize you have to give up some of your liberties to be safe. That's rather annoying to me. And not too long ago, we were at an airport, and I was talking with somebody, and I think it was just a casual conversation, and I was expressing my disdain for the TSA, you know, and their operation. And the person was saying, yeah, but just think, they've made us so much safer. Less free and no safer. You know, this is the whole thing. And now, you know, the statistics show that most of these things haven't accomplished anything. I mean, the TSA, how much have they presented? Every time they're tested, they flunk the test.
Yeah, like 90% they miss or more. Yeah, but they're very good at grabbing people and grabbing kids and doing things that they shouldn't do. But back to this LA Times piece, just to kind of, I guess, to get toward our closing. But it's, you know, I wrote this and I wrote myself some notes. LA Times sounds like RP, you, because here's what they said. The U.S. disbanded the Iraqi army, putting thousands of disgruntled men with military training on the street. Many rose up against what was perceived as a foreign invasion, feeding an insurgency that has never stopped. this is exactly what we thought would happen, and exactly how people behave when they're occupied, when they perceive they are, or actually they are, occupied by a foreign country. They fight for their homeland. We talked about, you know, Robert Pape has written about this a lot, and so many others have. When you view that you're fighting for your homeland, you're going to fight to the death because it's part of you. It's you know, it's your family, and that's, there's no amount of military that you can put on it that will change that.
See, I think it's the principle of the people willing to accept a function of government which is not permissible in a free society, but it's easily sold. And those who individuals who like to rule the world and orchestrate these wars and run the economy and the Federal Reserve and all the budget, and they argue the case. And people, it's very easy for them to say, well, I want to be safe. Who doesn't want to be safe? And they don't challenge and say, well, am I really safer, you know, by more swap teams, you know, you know, we keep hearing all these stories, and then when it comes to security, you know, and we argue the case for security, but we lose our liberties, and that's what John's piece of bun, his list of all the times that, and it's amazing that people just blow that off. I guess maybe they're playing these games or something, and that do it for a distraction. They don't want to think about things like that.
Well, I would just close by reminding people that if you didn't know, if you've been living in a hole somewhere, that organizations like ours, shows like this, are being shadow banned. They're being prevented from our followers being seen. Ron Paul Institute has 250,000 followers on Facebook, yet only 2,000 or 3,000 are actually shown the pieces that we put up on our Facebook page. They don't want you to read these things. One of the ways around it is to simply visit our website, ronpaulinstitute.org. Go there, and there's a little subscribe button, and we do a weekly update. We do a little bit of an exclusive article, and we give you all the links for the articles that we've put up during the day. We are not going to give away or sell your information. It's only for us, but we want to find a way to keep in touch with you because we're getting throttled. So please go there, subscribe to our YouTube channel while we still can. We can keep getting the information, but we have to be more creative in the way that we do it. Dr. Paul?
Well, you know, this whole problem with social media is a real challenge, and I always keep believing that there will be alternatives, and there are people working on it, and they're saying it's going to be available. But I think in the meantime, I'm not so sure why people can't use their email lists. I mean, they haven't closed down our emails. If you have 10 or 100 or 200, if everybody did this and encouraged those people to do that too, we can get a lot of message out. But when you think about how they did in our early history, it was pamphleteering and one-on-one and talking to each other and meeting people at your church, and messages got passed around, and the important people would read and study this, and they would have an opinion, and they did have an influence. So even in spite of what we think is a shortcoming now, which it is because we're curtailed from technology that should be available to us, but I think it'll iron its way out, but I think we have to be prepared to get around it, and I think anything an individual can do, because so many young people and others have started their own groups since the campaigns that I was involved in, and they do circulate things and they do get involved. So everybody has to be thoughtful and creative and get that message out. To me, though, the most important thing to start with is understanding the message, what liberty means, and why we don't want collectivism, why we don't want dependency on government, why we don't want you know, central banking to usurp the integrity of our monetary system. There's so much that we have to learn to be able to present this to other people. But then the vehicles are there, and I was always taught that if you have a message and you understand it, some people might just come and ask you the information, and I think that is true. I think if you become knowledgeable in the process of liberty and what liberty means, people are going to use you because they're always looking for information, but they want to trust you. And believe me, if you get one person to ask you a question, a sincere question about how this happens, and I found this to be the case when somebody would come up and sincerely ask me, why did you vote for it by yourself? And it wasn't a political question. It was strictly they wanted to have the information. So there's a lot we can do as individual. And once we understand this message and have the desire, believe me, there's a job out there for all of us. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. please come back soon.